that's running. And let me get this. And that's running. Okay. We're good to go. So, Gene, thanks for agreeing to do this. This will be, I think, an important contribution to the archive, the oral history archive that we're building for the ASA Environment and Technology section.
Pleasure is mine.
Great. I'd like to start out by covering some of your sort of personal background and then the sort of the broader institutional history of environmental sociology. So to begin, could you tell me a little bit about your educational background, your training, and eventually I'd like you to talk a little bit about your decision to become an environmental sociologist and whether or not that was a conscious decision on your part or something you fell into or how that came about.
My undergraduate institution is Rochester Institute of Technology, and the principal reason I went there is they had a co-op program, meaning it was a quarter system, and then beginning your junior year it alternated between working quarter and going to school quarter. Because I was putting myself through college with very little help from my parents, who were poor, and could live at home, that's where I went and got my undergraduate degree. And I got it in something practical, because I assumed I needed to have some steady work on a regular basis. Basically, I got it in accounting, and actually in my off-semester quarters, worked in a certified public accounting firm as a public accountant, and then minored in economics. But I had immediately, within the first or second year, an affinity or a particular proclivity to really get most of my enjoyment out of liberal arts courses rather than the business courses that I was required to take. So my thinking began to ferment along the lines of, how do I now pursue, having started the way I have, how do I now pursue something that I really feel I love, which is liberal arts? And then the idea of graduate school came up as a matter of that. So at the time I was in the Navy Reserve because I had been drafted to Vietnam. And both the National Guard and the, what's the other one? Army Reserve were filled. They had quotas that were filled up for months and months. So my chances were very good of getting drafted and getting sent to Vietnam, which I didn't want to do. So one option was to join the Navy Reserve, who, as long as you maintain an acceptable grade point average, would defer your active duty. So when I graduated undergraduate, I had to go and do 2 years of active duty in the Navy. And I was on a ship called an LSD, which stands for Landing Ship Dock, not Lysergic Acid Dithylamide. And then when I returned, I had a number of school loans because, as I say, I put myself through. And so I went and worked for a public accounting firm and got my loans paid off. I applied to, for graduate school, I only applied to places that had interdisciplinary programs. So Michigan State. I applied to a program at SUNY Binghamton and heard back from them. They had started a new program from a gaggle of young scholars from Berkeley around political economy, and they looked at my records, my undergraduate record, and were very impressed and said, you'd be better in our political economy program. So I actually applied there as well in political economy. And then Syracuse had a very strong interdisciplinary program. In the Maxwell School, which had a very good reputation. And on top of it, it got restricted inadvertently to universities in the state of New York because I won a statewide competition called the Herbert Lehman Fellowship. And the only stipulation was you had to do your graduate work in one of the New York universities. So so I chose Syracuse as my place to go, which it turns out for many reasons was a very good choice for me.
Can I just ask you quickly then, where did your feelings about interdisciplinary scholarship come in? At what point, and what, when you say interdisciplinary, what exactly are you talking about?
Well, I guess it's a combination of rationality and irrationality, which is maybe the way we do a lot of things. The irrational part was I wasn't exactly sure what to major in. So this was sort of a way to sort of wind your way around that problem. The other is, it was my experience, which got codified even further in graduate school, is if you went into a new area, a new subject area, for the first several weeks you're totally baffled because you're in a different linguistic paradigm, and so the terms are not familiar, etc. But once you get beyond that barrier, it's pretty easy to... There's a lot of similarity in what people are saying. It's just that we put up these silos or barriers and other things that in many ways are artificial. Useful institutionally, but artificial. And I thought, there's no reason for that in general. And the other reason was, no, it's more rationally, my first major in going to graduate school was international development. And I was very clearly convinced the economists did not have all the answers about international development. So I said there needs to be a larger context in which we try and understand how to get people who are poor or are otherwise disadvantaged, how to get them help themselves up by their bootstraps. And I definitely thought we needed some sociology and anthropology. So my triple studies were primarily economics, sociology, and anthropology. And for the interdisciplinary program at Syracuse, it required a lot of work. You had to take 75 hours of coursework, and you only got 15 hours for your dissertation as credit. So you got a pretty solid background in those three areas, or whatever three areas you chose. And then what happened was, Syracuse, when I applied, had internationally recognized programs in international development, both in Latin America and in West Africa, both of which were being disbanded. And so one of the real assets I'd gone there for now was disappearing. At the same time, the smartest person I ran into, anybody I was running into in terms of professors, was Alan Mazur, who just was head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of cleverness and creativity and so forth. And so he happened to be in sociology, so I revised my distribution so that I did whatever my 30 or 40 hours in sociology and the rest in anthropology and in economics. And then I actually never TA'd in sociology. I TA'd in anthropology, teaching cultural anthropology when I was in undergraduate school. I sort of slid into, by accident, the environment at that point in two ways. One is, as part of our methods course, which was taught by Alan Mazur, and this was taught to all the social science folks doing interdisciplinary work, is, I don't think you could do this nowadays. His assignment was, we did a survey he actually used in a study that he'd then published, and it was around nuclear energy. And so I began to get some acquaintance with nuclear energy and energy in general. And then based on the work I did in that course, he told me about other models of how to go through graduate school. And one was to really identify with a mentor and go through under a mentorship rather than just being one of a number of students. So basically I apprenticed myself to him. I had my own money, so he didn't have to support me because I had this Lehman Fellowship. And then when that ran out, because I had such good standing, they gave me TA ships that I used in anthropology. So I did a lot of independent work with them. We published like something like 5 papers while I was a graduate student.
And what was the nature of that work?
Well, one of it was it was around the first oil crisis in 1973 and 74, And there was a scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, Sam Klausner, who had an institute there called the Center for the Research on Man, something really grandiose like that. And he organized a session of social scientists at the AAAS meetings, American Association for Advancement of Science, around the topic of energy, because it was clearly in the air. Because this is just, the oil and carbon embargo ended in March and the AAAS meetings were in February, so it was full blown within the context of that. And if there were people who remember this, there will be people who won't remember this. The gas lines were so horrendous at the gas station. A couple of things happened. One is California switched an odd-even day. If your license plate ended in odd, you went one day and so forth. There were some shootings at some gas stations. And then some clever entrepreneurs used wealthy executives would hire these temporary workers, like from Manpower and Kelly Girl, to sit in the car and wait at the gas lines. Anyway, so this was very much in everyone's mind. And it was Alan's idea. And the question was, all right, so the uniformly conventional wisdom, virtually unchallenged, was, all right, we've got to increase our supply. Okay, if that means weaning ourselves off of Mideast oil, whatever it happens to be, that's the sole answer. And he said, well, there's another way of doing it, that is reduce demand. I mean, it's two sides of the same coin, more like. So he got me to be interested in that. We got accepted on that program. And so I spent Christmas break in the library in those days, handwriting and code sheets. The UN data from Series J, I think it is, that had international energy statistics, as well as a whole variety of, I recorded a whole variety of quality of life statistics, life expectancy, levels of education, a whole variety of things. And we just asked the question, what would happen if you reduce demand, what kind of social consequences would have? And the answer was not really many at all. And it's only later that people like Amory Lovins and Lee Shipper and a number of these folks from a technical side began to see this as a realistic possibility. And that became part of the conversation in terms of a national energy policy.
Where did you publish those early papers?
That one was published in Science Magazine, 1974. It pretty much stands up. First of all, if you go back, it kind of is amusing at how primitive the methods we use. Because basically, all we looked at was correlation coefficients, which today would not fly at all. But even if you do more sophisticated controlled analyses, you find out the basic message is the same. And now if you add in things like more recent work with Kyle Knight, just finishing his degree on subjective well-being and happiness, you find it even stronger in the sense that not only does it doesn't show up with a so-called objective indicator, it doesn't show it up in people's experience either. So other things are more important: social capital, equitable distribution of wealth, a variety of other things, and energy and some of these resource uses are just and clear sense, but just wasteful.
And so was this early work on nuclear energy, was this your dissertation, or was this a
no,
side project?
No, I did my dissertation in biosociology, which is I was looking at, let me put a context here. My mentor, Alan, always had a macro project and a micro project going. And that comes from one of his mentors, which was Art Stinchcomb, who advised him as a graduate student, it's a good idea to have a macro project, a micro project going up. If you get bored with one, you can always go to the other one. So that was Allen's standard approach. So his micro work was on integrating the primate evidence with human behavior was one aspect of it. The other was looking at physiological measures of mood and so forth. And so my dissertation was about whether some of the subtle signaling systems of primates, especially chimpanzees, applied to humans. And the evidence seemed to show that it does.
So was this experimental work?
Yeah. Basically, we wanted to see if eye behavior would predict status hierarchies in small groups. And we were able to do so with some moderate degree. Our job market was horrendous right then, even worse than it's been in the last couple of years. So, out of desperation, I applied for an NSF fellowship, postdoctoral fellowship, in energy studies. And likely because almost nobody had published in that area, except I had now this paper in Science, and was part of this survey that had done nuclear power. I probably was a good outlier for them, so I got a fellowship with the National Science Foundation. And I was able to work it to go to Stanford because my mentor had worked there for a couple years and had interacted with the engineering department. He didn't stay ensconced in the sociology department. In fact, I think he jointly taught something with one of the engineers. So he reactivated that contact as a sponsor, and it was Tom Connelly. He said, fine, bring him out. So I went out there, and I did both those things again. I was looking at brain waves and seeing if brain waves would predict people's behavior in small groups. At the same time, I was a member of a team that assessed and created a national model based on what Amory Lovin's work that came out in about 1978 that said we could get along with about half the energy we were using and see no real change in our social patterns, our quality of life, and so forth. And so we had a unique take on this that no one else that I know of has done, is when we created our scenarios, which was the sort of the sine qua non of how to do that sort of national modeling of energy systems. We started with social scenarios based upon what we thought would be prevailing values. Now, in many ways, it looks crude and primitive in retrospect, but it was actually breakthrough thinking. And if the folks at Stanford were clever, they would have marketed it in a much better way. Because shortly thereafter, Harvard produced a book called, the title escapes me, might be Energy Futures or something like that, that became a bestseller. Did a review of what things were and where the leaky parts were and which parts could be plugged and so forth. Anyway, so so that got me. That's it. So I was an energy guy, basically, not knowing that there was such a thing as environmental sociology. I was just doing this because they seemed like interesting problems to me.
Well, I was going to ask you going back to Syracuse and then moving to Stanford. At either of those places, I mean, other than Alan Mazur, were there any other people in those academic contexts who were doing what you would today call environmental sociology?
Nobody that I knew. The first one I met that had anything like that was Riley Dunlap at a meeting of ASA in about 76 or 77, something like that, with Jim Short. Introduced me to Riley. But up to that point, I had no idea there was such a specialty in sociology.
So you met those two when you were at Stanford?
I met Jim Short while I was at Stanford because he was working. He was an advisor to a big project run out of SRI International, which is used to be Stanford Research Institute, but because of the 60s, all these research wings of the universities had to separate because of a lot of their funding was coming from sources that were politically incorrect.
Yeah.
And so anyway, but there was a big project, SRSI, that was had Nancy Tuma and Mike Hannon very much involved, and their student was Peggy Thoit, who was my partner at the time. And so Jim Short was an advisor to that, so he'd come to Stanford several times. And so I met him there, and then he's the one who told me about.
Do you recall, I mean, that was a long time ago, do you recall the nature of those discussions, those very early discussions with Jim or Riley?
Well, Jim had little to say about the environmental, social environment itself. His main connection was to say, oh, I should talk to Riley Dunlap. And so at the next ASA meetings, whenever that was, 76, 77, 1870, I don't think 78, but I got hired in 78. I made a point of getting with our... First of all, I hadn't even heard of Washington State University. So...
Where? Sorry?
Yeah, right. I was asking questions about where's it located, what's it like around there, what are the amenities and so forth, those kinds of questions. But anyway... And so it was a very, very tight market, and both my partner and I got jobs. And that was before spousal accommodation. That was just flat out. They hired both of us at the same time.
So WSU?
Yeah.
And that was in 1978? 78. And so, and prior to that, you had talked to Riley. And 78, if I recall, is the same year that he and Catton's first paper
was published.
Yeah.
Right.
So do you have, I mean, again, do you recall any kind of discussions with Riley or anybody else at WSU I'm interested in hearing you talk about sort of the nucleus of this field and your perceptions of how that came about.
First of all, Riley, as he still is, was very enthusiastic about the field and extremely encouraging to me to do my work there rather than the other things I was doing. The other was, within a matter of a year or so, we hired Bill Freudenberg, Marv Olson, who was a fairly well-respected political sociologist, and we had a demographer who sort of was interested in the environment, although often it was as a matter of counterpoint. So all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we had four or five people around an area that almost nobody had anyone. And key thing that happened for me was, I thought, well, here's an opportunity to be at the foundation of the building of an institution, and we've got a critical mass to do it with. And so that, through some pretty thin times in a personal way, motivated me to stay and contribute to the emergence of this and the perpetuation of the institution, and I'm glad he did. And so then we've been fairly successful in maintaining a certain core of people to do this. Then a little later on, Lee Fries, who became chair, read Bill Catton's book as a matter of being the chair's duties, and had a total epiphany. And started doing entirely work on the environment that he had never done before. So try to do theoretical work and formalize some of the things that were being said in sort of a casual, ordinary language way. So we had this sort of continuous revival of interest in the area. And we were also getting to have some success in terms of publications and places to publish and so forth. as the field got spread a bit in a larger institution.
So let me take this line of questioning in two slightly different directions. You've repeatedly referred to as the field, circa 1976, 77. Right. To what extent was there a field of environmental sociology at that time, rather than a handful of people who were interested in this project? That is,
I would say your latter description is more accurate of what was really there. There was people like somebody you probably never heard of, Charlie Wolf, who was doing social impact assessment, which was a big deal at the time.
Was he at WSU?
No, he was at CUNY, I think. Maybe even an independent consultant. And then when Freudenberg got his PhD, that's what he studied. At a town in Colorado. Mm-hmm. So there were these, for the most part, isolated individuals doing this work. So in that sense, there was no field in a conscious way as later it would emerge.
And so, going back to the sort of departmental context at WSU in the mid to late 70s, were the four or five of you who found yourself employed there consciously? I mean, to what extent did you all consciously and collectively go about laying down, in a strategic way, sort of the institutional foundations for this field? Or, yeah, I'll just ask you that.
Well, we did a number of activities that would point in that direction. So, for example, Bill Freudenberg and I organized a regular informal colloquium that we went around each of different either faculty or student houses and basically did what we're doing now in 201, that is our conference room, mm-hmm. doing it much less formally and supportive and typically had refreshments, etc., and got students to make presentations that they might not otherwise make because of the context and so forth, the physical context. There was action. There was concerted action to get sessions at key meetings. Again, we didn't sit down and say, we have to do this to get an institution. But it just seemed like a number of things seemed like the right thing to do. That if you were actually laying out a strategy, you would do them anyway. But I don't think we ever sat down and said, we're about to.
So another sort of piece of that sort of, I guess, repertoire tactics that you're describing is a directory that is cited in those early papers by Catton and Dunlap that somebody at WSU put together, that a directory of people around the country, sociologists, I think, primarily, who WSU folks saw as doing relevant environmental sociological work. Do you know anything about that directory and who put it together?
My best guess is it was Kent Van Leer, who was Riley's first and very successful student in the private sector. He started out, Tennessee, I think, University of Tennessee, which he sort of laid the groundwork for them to have a fairly robust program. And then he got hooked up with Tom Heberlein at Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Tom had a research job. And they built that shop up to where it was very profitable, and he made quite a bit of money, I think. But I don't know where he went after that. But I think it was probably Kent that was most of, my guess is Riley's name was on it somewhere. My guess is probably a lot of the legwork was done by Kent.
And the other institutional question I have about WSU in those early years was the reactions that you all got from other departments and from administration. Was there general support when you went outside of the department? Or did you go outside of the department? And what kind of reactions did you get?
Well, let's start in the department. There was remarkable support given we were taking a risk. With one or two exceptions, one of whom you could imagine, a person you can imagine, that you passed over with. But for the most part, there was considerable amount of support for us to do whatever it was. Just do it well and get recognition for it was the bottom line. And so we took that as something of a license to just go forward and try to do best we can in terms of doing good work and making it visible. The element at that point in time, the resources here were remarkably greater, and there was virtually zero emphasis on us bringing in external funding. So we could do just about what we wanted to in terms of intellectual pursuits, in terms of how we went about our business and so forth. In many ways, I'm a little bit nostalgic about those times. Almost every job applicant that I know of now, one of the elements of their concern that in the hiring process is whether they're going to be rainmakers or not.
Right.
Even small liberal arts colleges are asking about that. So we didn't have that constraint. Administration, I would say either benign neglect or certainly not any pushback. And then it turns out we got a dean from political science, John Pierce, who had done some work on the environment through political science and was extremely supportive. And he was a dean for a very long time. I think twice as long as any other deans, and then it was then the Pac-10, now the Pac-12. So I think he was dean for 15 or so years or something like that. And he was very supportive. And he's the one that got the Boeing professorship for the department, as well as the Meyer professorships that are distributed. One way to get a Meyer professorship is to focus on the environment. So that was an important institutional push from the dean's level. At the upper administration, sort of the same, I heard the same message, basically. We're not particularly concerned about what you do, just do it well and bring good visibility to the university.
Other departments? Was there an effort to reach out beyond sociology in those early years?
Not that I recall, and certainly not to the extent I would like to have seen it. I had some involvement with the then Office of Applied Energy Studies, who had a colloquium series that I took part in. And I may be missing something, but because this is going back quite a ways, but I don't think there was much outreach in that sense. For one thing, the department has a certain amount of, for lack of a better term, arrogance. We are definitely one of the best departments in the university. And in some cases, probably the best department. And then, as time went on, we lost a lot of resources. So it was harder to maintain that. And secondly, the university was clever in promoting other departments that really lifted themselves up. By long strides. So as a result, I don't think we look far beyond our own borders for those kinds of things that we know we sort of take for granted now.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's interesting. Why don't we shift gears now away from sort of WSU per se, and think about the larger field a little bit. in the sort of the broader scope of the of environmental sociology's history. And I'd just like you to take me through some of the key, what you see as some of the key turning points in the development of the field. And, you know, maybe along the way, sort of comment on how those debates or new insights or innovations shaped your own thinking and your own sort of research trajectory.
Okay. Do you have a
It's a prelim question.
Do you have a STEM question I can respond to?
Well, what do you see as the major? What do you see as the fundamental sort of innovations or turning publications or projects that have really moved the field forward in the last 20, 30 years?
Well, that's a tough question.
You know what? Let's come back to that, actually. There's something else that I've got here that in my notes that I scribbled down that I think I want to touch on because it has to do with you and this question of interdisciplinarity, which came up immediately in our conversation and really hasn't gone away, which is that, I mean, when I look at your work and the work that you've produced, it is strikingly interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
I haven't done a count, but my guess would be you have as many publications in non-sociology journals as you do in sociology journals.
Probably, maybe more. Close.
Yeah. So maybe you could say a little bit about your own experience working in, you know, in the field of energy studies, in risk science, risk analysis. And what it's like to work with not just other social scientists, but natural scientists as well, and how you came to get involved with those other communities, and how that's shaped your thinking.
Well, in terms of working with, interacting with people outside your field, it forces you to be a student again. And so, to me, that's an exciting proposition because it means you're going to learn something and learn it beyond what would be the normal boundaries of whatever field you're working in. And also, sometimes it means serious counterpoint to your thinking, which is sort of a mental mental hygiene. Because we can easily go along a path where we think we really have, I wouldn't say truth, but we really got a good purchase on whatever it is we're thinking about. And these are useful ways to have that purchase bump up against other realities that may be just as viable and just as reasonable. So I think part of our job as scholars and researchers is to be learning at all times. And there's a lot of ways of doing that. I just happen to find that the interdisciplinary context is a very rewarding way of doing it, and two, one that almost forces you to do it. It's pretty hard to be a team player in a context like that without doing your homework and knowing some of the basics of the other field. And so I would say that's the core element of it.
Did you find in those experiences, and I don't have a good sense, so you might want to talk a little bit about your work in those interdisciplinary contexts. In your experience, though, how have scientists treated your work and your contributions? Is there?
Well. I would have to say that in a variety of the contexts I've found myself in, for example, I worked on the safety of nuclear power plants in terms of control rooms with a group of physicists and engineers, and it was readily accepted because they recognized the need for the kind of knowledge I was going to bring to the situation. And the same is true now. I'm working with biologists at Stanford who feel the same way. There's sort of a natural affinity to be in contacts where if you're invited, then typically you're going to be, your work is going to be thought of in a positive way and you're going to be supported. The other place where it shows up is in who cites your work. And so people in the other sciences who I have never met or probably never will apparently find the work in itself useful. And I've also had this experience, which I thought was quite interesting. I wrote up, there wasn't a, in terms of nuclear power, there was, and there is this notion of second form of transmutation. So nuclear power, in terms of normal fission processes where you split an atom, and the, by doing that, you release a tremendous amount of energy. But then you basically use heat water and drive turbines. One of the major problems, which we're still haven't solved, is the waste, because it includes a lot of plutonium, which is bomb-grade material. Well, there was a proposal that came out of Star Wars, where the technology was due to Star Wars, where there would be a second order transmutation to take the waste, I think to blast it with more neutrons or something, and then render it fairly innocuous. And therefore, you'd have much easier way of sequestering it than you do now, which is still challenging us. And I wrote up about that in an article. And I had a scientist from Los Alamos call me to ask me some questions about the article. And somehow I got around to, what's your position? I said, well, I'm a professor of sociology at Washington State University. He said, I thought for sure you were a physicist. That was one of the most gratifying days of my life, that I could translate something quite scientific and write it in a way that another scientist thought it was a scientist. I guess there's a knack, too, of how you absorb this information and put it out there.
Right. That's a great story. So we've talked a bit about, a fair bit about your work in energy, but you're also known quite well for your work in human ecology. Can you, how did you get hooked into human ecology and that work? And maybe you can tell me a little bit about the development of STIRPAD and that whole side of your research program.
Yeah, and about, may have the dates a little bit off, but they'll be roughly correct. In about 1992, or thereabouts, the National Academy of Sciences discovered that the real problem with many of our environmental issues were, just like Pogo discovered, due to humans. And yet they had no committees, they had nothing at the academy that really was dealing with this issue. So I think it was originally an NSF-initiated ad hoc committee that was created called the Human Dimensions of Global Change. And Paul Stern was the chair, was the staff director of that committee. And it had the key sociologist down there was Tom Dietz. And had a group of political scientists like Orrin Young, geographers, and some, and they always had at least one physical scientist to sort of keep the social scientists honest. Anyway, I produced a report, I think in 1994, that's referred to as the Rainbow Book, which is called the Human, I think it's the name, Human Dimensions of Global Change or something like that. And they were trying to piece together the little evidence there was that people hadn't worked out well. Piece together the available evidence, of which there wasn't a great surfeit of around issues of human difference in the environment interaction. And one of the ways they organized their thinking was to take from Paul Ehrlich and John Holdren and Barry Commoner this little accounting formula: the impacts to the environment are a function of a multiplicative function, population affluence, and technology. Well, immediately, if you look at the equation itself, it's sort of tautological in a lot of ways, which we, I think, in the social sciences get much better training in the philosophy of science and are much more disabused of using tautologies, as are necessarily natural scientists, which I find interesting in some way. But anyway, so Tom Dietz was thinking about this quite a bit. And the main thing he couldn't figure out on his own was how to measure the technology variable. So we were at Triple S meetings in Chicago. I don't remember what year. It might have been really, it was early 80s. And I seldom would we find ourselves in a saloon together, but we so happened to have been in a saloon together. And we started writing the equation out on a napkin and asking ourselves a question: how can we measure technology that's not tautological? Because the way it typically was done was a ratio to energy, which if you pieced all this apart, basically comes out to a circular reasoning. And so he said, wait a minute, we convert this to a stochastic form. We could put it in the Earth term, and therefore we got that culture in there. Anything else that's doing this. But the main thing is we can do this test, this stuff with Gregory regression. So it was sort of a combination of his insight and my encouragement, and the fact that we probably had had 3 or 4 beers by that point. And so we write the stuff down, and that started it. And so the first thing we needed to do, at least we discussed it, was to articulate what it is we wanted to do, what had been done before and what was wrong with it, and how this might be a way of moving forward and getting a deeper understanding of the human ecology at a structural level. So we wrote this article for Human Ecology Review in 1994 that basically starts with the question: how can we better understand the interaction between humans and the environment? And then we laid out some of the approaches that have been tried, including Otis Dudley Duncan's poet model, and several other things, and then said, here's another option. So that's what we laid out, what the estimation procedure would be and how you would interpret the results. And I hadn't done a lick of empirical work at that point. It was all a matter of conceptualizing what we would do. And then it was a matter thereafter of asking, what we tried to avoid was Mark Twain's Little Boy with a Hammer, where the world starts looking like tacks, where we try to find data and context that seem to be amenable to using that model without forcing variables into the model that didn't belong. And so sequentially went along and said, okay, what if we add this, or what if we do that? What if we consider this different dependent variable, what happens? What if it's the ecological footprint versus CO2 loads, etc. And so that inherently it built up a research program. And when we played out the impact part of that, we then switched directions, which is what Kyle's done a lot of work with me now about, is to ask the question in a different way. So the question originally driving most of everything is, what human factors at a structural level are causing most of the impacts on the environment? Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. We then anticipated a neoliberal response, which is Yeah, but you only give us half the equation. People are living a lot longer. People are enjoying life. There's all kinds of reason to believe the cost to the environment is worth it in terms of life satisfaction, happiness, and so forth. So now we've been doing analysis to make a comparison. All right. Is it true that these impacts are creating? And the answer is no, we don't find it. So we're midstream on that. I'm not sure what we'll do next there, but it's been a rich experience. And the most popular version of our output is the article that Richard York and I did, and Tom, from Richard's dissertation, that has a considerable number of citations.
I'm struck in this story and other stories you've told today about how it seems to me, and this is just, you tell me if this is on track or not, that your research programs have developed, seem to have developed in response to institutional incentives or opportunities. That is, in this latest story, you were responding to a National Academy of Sciences report and a mission. And before, you know, a lot of your risk work and energy work has responded to similar sorts of institutional mandates or opportunities from government agencies or whatnot. A, do you think that's an accurate sort of statement, a sort of general statement about how you've sort of chosen research problems? And then B, the inverse of that is, to what extent have debates, ideas, trends within the discipline of sociology been influential in shaping your research trajectories and ideas?
Let me answer the first one, the second one first. I can't think of where the latter has been very influential. Because, first of all, the first rule of the ecology work I've done is every analysis, this is not true conceptual work, but in terms of empirical analysis, must be a combination of physical and social variables. And for most of the discipline, physical variables just don't exist. Or they're so taken for granted that they're not problematic in any sense of the word. And so there's not a large corpus of debate or influence that really can come from there. On the first issue, at one level, I would say your interpretation is correct. But I think I'm working at a different level, and that is, who is going to provide the context and the conversation where the key issues are really going to be honed, where you can figure out what's a serious thing to work on? And Academy happens to be one vehicle where this takes place. I mean, that's their job. And so they summarize what we know, but the main point is they also lead us in directions to tell us what we don't know and where we should probably direct our efforts. So that's, in that sense, if one wants to say that's institutionally driven, that's correct. But it's really not that. It's where do you go to look for the best challenges and the most challenging ideas that you can deal with, and try to translate them in something that's workable. There's an add-on to the sort of the less than glowing things I had to say about sociology. And a lot of the sociology, or the environmental sociology, a lot of it is to massage traditional concerns of sociology by throwing an environmental variable in mix. And that sort of butts up against this principle I try to follow, where it's not that there are interactional issues that haven't been studied before, that if we could fall into that pattern, we're not going to make the kind of discoveries I think that we need to do to really move our fields forward.
So what do you think the future... Let's follow up that a little bit. So I'll go back to that question I posed earlier, try to get some traction on it. What, in thinking about the sort of history of environmental sociology as a field, where do you think it's taken wrong turns, or why is it, given that we're now 30 years beyond the HEPNEP framework, that so much environmental sociology still looks like sociology?
Well, most, I don't want to impose motivations on others, but institutionally, making careers means publications and research funds and so forth. And there's a risky path and a less risky path. And the less risky path is to expand on what's already there institutionally. I want to say this in a way that's not shamelessly self-promoting, but I've taken on a lot of big risks in my career. All these things that I did could have easily fallen on its face. I had no way of knowing for sure. And in fact, I must tell you, one of my... I eventually published it in Social Forces, but my dissertation, I sent it to one journal, and they sent back and said, this is not even sociology. So I think there's an element of wanting to take risks and being a risk taker. Because there are a lot of opportunities to do good work and do interesting work, but stay within a fairly narrow, I'm kind of reluctant to use the word, but I'll use it anyway, paradigm, rather than moving outside the paradigm and maybe even challenging it.
Do you have any thoughts about about how some of those institutional barriers and cultural barriers can be broken down?
Well, I'll tell you, if I had the answer to that, we'd be doing a lot of different things at a lot of different universities. What's happened, though, there's an encouraging part and a discouraging part. The encouraging part is the recognition that we need to do a lot more of that, and at the universities in particular, is now very widespread, which it wasn't for a long time. You brought up 20, 30 years ago, bringing up the idea of interdisciplinarity, and you were mad. That's no longer the case. In fact, now the institutions are asking this question. One obvious place, and they've done so to a certain extent, is for agencies like the National Academy, like the National Science Foundation, to structure their funding around these sorts of things. And they do have some programs now that are fairly big programs that are where they require, in fact, more and more of their programs are requiring that they be real interdisciplinary and not just superficially. So it's not just an organic chemist and a biochemist. It's where it's maybe a chemist, a physicist, a social scientist, even a legal scholar, whatever. So, and because the universities are being commodified, who does some of the commodification but agencies like the National Science Foundation? So there's ways of doing it that way, used institutionally. The other, I suppose, is to demonstrate that you can make a career by doing that. so that young people have some model to follow where it doesn't seem as risky as it might otherwise.
Could talk a little bit about policy and how you have striven or strove to connect your work to policy domains, policy problems, and the sort of impact you think your work has had on policy?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I never had any intention of really doing policy, but it sort of just happened in the sense that some of the topics I chose to work on really had no deep intellectual theoretical content to them, but merely were how you better inform policy with these. But it connects now. There's been a development that where this is now becoming widely accepted as a perspective. And in fact, there's a section of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that was led by Bill Clark and Bob Cates and Roger Kasperson and my friend, late friend Steve Schneider and others on sustainability. And they were influenced as now as much of the Beltway with a book by Stokes, political scientist, called Pasteur's Quadrant.
Yes.
And what it did was it said this dichotomy between pure and applied science, or pure, you could say curiosity-driven versus policy, is a fiction created by the guy that really set the stage for the National Science Foundation, whose name escapes me at the moment, Vannevar Bush. He pushed that through the Congress on the basis that we only want to fund pure science because it trickles down. It's a trickle-down theory of science, basically. And Stokes pointed out that really a lot of science is not one or the other. It's in the middle, called use-inspired science. And his paradigmatic example of that is Louis Pasteur. Although I've been reading about Bacon lately, and Bacon was an exemplar of that as well, where they started with a practical problem and then used that practical problem to make much larger discovery. So one of the first things that Pasteur studied was how beets turn into alcohol. Well, you know, eventually he took that and some other studies and figured out germ theory, which by any standards is a pretty powerful thing to discover. So that connects up what now is policy relevant work with the human ecology work, because they both now proceed under the notion that you sort of got this flow in of that's inspired by use, whether it's either additional knowledge about what we're doing to the environment, and therefore gives you key leverage points on what we can do to change things, or you got key information about how policy might be done better. And it either flows up to adding to theory or flows down to policy. But it all emanates from this idea of use-inspired research.
And you've been on, have you not been on committees that have looked at and tried to more directly contribute to policy discussions or decisions?
Well, it turns out, yes. I served two terms on the Human Dimensions Committee that I mentioned, where a lot of this stir-pat business got started. And then four other committees of National Academy. The one that most directly influenced policy was a committee on nuclear waste I served on. So that was, I think, in 2002, somewhere around there, 2003. And in January of 2009, recognizing that there was a serious problem with the waste program in the U.S., Nevada was not going to take nuclear waste, especially not as long as Harry Reid was Senate Majority Leader. Obama appointed a Blue Ribbon Commission to see what we could do about getting a better solution in nuclear waste. That commission leaned heavily on that report that I was a part of for the National Academy in 2002-2003. And in fact, they've adopted a number of the features of that report, including staging the repository, including, much to my satisfaction, much more and greater involvement of the public at every stage of the process. In fact, they're now taking steps to try to implement the. And so the Blue Ribbon Commission produced a report in March of this year, I think. And now they're trying to figure out how to implement it. And the implementation is very much along the lines of what we outlined in that 2002 or 2003 National Academy report.
Right. Must be gratifying.
It is gratifying, you know, even though there's a time interruption and there's dilutions of some things and accentuations of others. It's very gratifying, it is indeed.
So I've got one more question, and we can talk more if you want.
Right.
But what would be your, looking forward, what would be your hopes for the field of environmental sociology? What would you most sort of hope it is able eventually to succeed at?
Well, perhaps a much more active role in interdisciplinarity. I think the door, certainly the door is open, more so than I've ever seen before. But we just have to walk through. The other is, Misty?
That's okay. I think we'll get it.
There's a remarkable opportunity to be engaged in much larger projects than we can take on by ourselves if we're willing to be part of an interdisciplinary team. And what that means in many cases, this is the other reason, has less to do with risk and more to do with one's self-identity in terms of group processes, is it often means you're going to have to be the soldier and not the leader, because the problem is often to be driven by the science of the issue rather than the social aspects. On the other hand, there's instances where it's defined that way, but it really is more social than scientific, something you would probably know better than anyone, in which case then there's a strong role to make that case and to get important social science information into the process. And there's more and more opportunities for this. The other one, which I haven't fully resolved in my own mind, but I think is part of what we should be doing. I've been inculcated, like many others, in sort of a new positivistic viewpoint, where our job is to do the science and leave the action to others. Some of these areas of research are such that others are not going to see it unless we do something about it. So I'm not sure at what level of activism we should be to maintain our professional standing. But I do think we need to do more active participation in actually trying to solve problems than just analyzing and outlining them. So for example, Fred Buttle in that 2000 article in ASR pointed out that the majority of our field is to point out what the problems are. Well, okay, we're diagnosticians, but I think this is the time to start thinking about also being practitioners in some sense of the word.
It's interesting, because I think there's some, I mean, I guess I should pose this as a question. Do you see a tension between those directions toward greater engagement in public education, public decision-making processes on the one hand, greater engagement with scientists in interdisciplinary work relative to the work that would be required to maintain and expand and extend our the field's identity and status within sociology. That is, if we all went out and did it, a lot of interdisciplinary research, maybe we'd stop being environmental sociology. We'd stop being we.
I think that's a danger, yes. But I'm a risk taker. The tension has always been in the discipline. In fact, John Turner and another Turner wrote a book a few years ago where it talks about sociology is characterized by this social welfare inclination on one hand and scientific inclination on the other that's never been resolved. And I think that's probably still true. So this sort of revives that tension in a different context. But having role models like Steve Schneider, where he can do his work to the extent of being considered one of the top climate scientists in the world, and yet go around the world and say, look, if we don't do this, bad things are going to happen. It didn't vitiate his status as a scientist. And to what extent he's changed some minds, I think, has been a very important aspect of his legacy. So there certainly is a possibility of this. It doesn't mean everybody can do it or can do it well, but I think we need to do more of it. At least stand up and get the facts as we best know them, at the very least.
That's great. That might be a good place to stop, unless okay. If we have more to.
No, I think that's good.
Okay, yeah. Great. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, this has been a pleasure.
Yeah, great.
So, what are you doing? How are you doing for the summer? What are you doing?
We are getting ready to go down to New Orleans for a sabbatical year.
For the whole year?
For the whole year. And so I would really love to try to get, we should try again to have dinner together sometime in the next month. So yeah, that's our plan. We've got our house rented out starting August 1st. A new faculty member in the Department of Human Development is coming in, and she and her husband are going to take the place for a year. We're now in the process of trying to find a home to rent in New Orleans, but it's about places that will be available August 1st are just now starting to be advertised, so I think sometime in the next couple of weeks we'll figure that piece out. Beth and I both have appointments at the Tulane School of Public Health for the year, and they've given us offices and library privileges and such. My main goal for the next year is to write a book about the environmental health risks in Katrina. I've got other stuff that's piled up as well, so I don't know if it's actually going to happen. A year seems like a really long time, and not so long. It's not so long, so we'll see what that brings. Thank you. Wonder why. Let me get this turned off. Yeah, I hope the last few minutes of that come out and aren't washed out by the vacuum, but I think we certainly got most of it, if not.
So, all right, so what's Beth going to do at this stage?
Coniglia?
Yeah.
With this stuff?
Yeah.
So, I'm not exactly sure. It's not turning off, yeah. Keeps going then we'd really need to run.
Exactly.